That's how I start the meeting.
All right, thank you. We'll come back to order, and the time is about 2 minutes after 1 o'clock p.m. Central Time. And we're going to, at this time, continue with the hearing and the witness, Laura McCartan. I believe, Carrie Valley, you had some questions for Ms. McCartan. Oh, I'm going to mention we have a new court reporter this afternoon. This is Linda Gingery from Amineth and Associates, and Denise Andahl will be back after the dinner break tonight. All right, let's proceed.
Thank you, Judge Fetch, Commissioners. Ms. McCartan, I just have a few follow-up questions from our discussion today. The commissioners asked you about the rate case drivers in this case and where in the testimony they could find that. And I'd point you to page 5 of your direct testimony.
Yes, I'm there.
And does figure 1 outline the case drivers and the proportions of the case that are related to those?
Yes, it does. I apologize for overlooking this, but earlier I was asked a question as to what proportion of the total request relates to nuclear and transmission, if I recall correctly. And if you look at this chart, those two items together are close to, well, they are $12 million, so it's approximately, you know, something under 75% of the total request. We did modify our request. And the total request is now 14.9, but I believe that the nuclear and transmission total amounts are still very comparable to what is shown in this table.
Thank you. And an additional question that was raised was about future insurance increases. Are there any future insurance increases either related to Sherco or any other matter that are included in this case?
No.
And following up on the question on incentive compensation, the question from advocacy staff counsel was what the basis for the Wisconsin decision was on AIP. And did you include the Wisconsin order in your as an exhibit to your rebuttal testimony?
It is an exhibit to my rebuttal testimony, yes.
And is it your understanding that the order reflects the decision-making of the commission and the rationale that they adopted?
Yes.
Ms. McCartan, on the pension expenses, just for clarification to for some of the questions that were raised regarding that, does the company use actuarial studies to plan for meeting its future pension obligations?
Yes, we do use actuarial studies, and we are accounting for the expected longer lives of current employees. So that factor is planned for in our pension plan.
And for the test year pension amounts, not reflecting anything outside the test year, does this include an amortized portion of the 2008 market loss?
Yes, it does. It includes an amortized portion of the 2008 market loss. And our mitigation proposal would be to further extend the amortization period.
Another question that was raised was on the company's performance for 2012. And was the authorized return on equity for 2012 10.4%?
For the North Dakota jurisdiction, the 2012 authorized ROE was 10.4%.
And do you know what the actual earned rate of return on equity was in 2012?
Yes, we calculated that and actually provided that to the commission. We calculated that as a weather normalized and then as just straight actual number. The weather normalized return on equity in 2012 was 8.92% for the North Dakota jurisdiction.
So the company did not over-earn in 2012?
No.
Thank you, Ms. McCartan.
All right. That's all the questions. Let's go to Ryan Norrell. Do you have any more questions for Ms. McCartan?
Just a few, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I would like to, may I approach the witness with some, with an exhibit I propose to
Yes, yes.
Your Honor, the document I've handed out is from the Greater North Dakota Chamber of Commerce's website. It's three documents, or three pages long. A couple of them may be two-sided.
Not the ones I have.
I think the black and white copies, there may be a different copy.
All right. Thank you. But three pages in total.
Three pages in total, that's correct. And we would move to enter this as exhibit, I think, PSC 10.
Are there any objections, Ms. Valley?
Thank you, Judge. No objections.
All right, thank you. Exhibit PSC 10 is admitted.
Thank you, Your Honor. I offer this exhibit just in clarification of some questions that Commissioner Chrisman had been asking about economic development. Is XL Energy or NSP part of the Greater North Dakota Chamber of Commerce at all?
Yes.
And is it true that the company is seeking to, they're trying to get 50% of economic development costs back from ratepayers? Is that correct?
Correct.
And Commissioner Chrisman raised some issues about lobbying, and as you had said, part of doing business is lobbying for economic development. Is that correct?
Yes.
The first two pages, on the second page, I would like to just draw attention to about a quarter of the way down, it does state that Mr. Mark Nisbet is a member or a representative of XL Energy and is a member of the Greater North Dakota Chamber of Commerce. Is that correct?
That's correct.
On the third page, I would like to draw attention about three-fourths of the way down on the third page is House Bill 1064, and it points out where the Chamber of Commerce stands on each of these. Thumbs up would be support, thumbs down would be oppose, two lines would be no action. Could you tell me what 1064, what the position would be for the North Dakota Chamber of Commerce?
1064, relating to the maximum penalty for a violation of pipeline safety standards.
And what would what was the position of the Chamber of Commerce?
There is an icon here that indicates a thumbs down position.
Were you aware that the North Dakota Public Service Commission was a sponsoring agency of that bill?
I may have been, but it's not something that I can recollect certain right here.
I guess our staff's position is, why should we allow for recovery of funds that go to lobbying against positions that we would take?
Well, the North Dakota Chamber of Commerce represents a diverse set of views, certainly. XL Energy is one of those, and you can even see from the list of the board members the diversity of the businesses that are a part of the North Dakota Chamber. So, although I'm not directly involved with the North Dakota Chamber, I think it probably functions as many others, is that they poll their members and see whether they have majority support for certain policy decisions to take. So I don't know that we would have supported everything down the line. I haven't reviewed this carefully. So I guess it's part of what happens when you belong to an organization that does represent a broad base of interests. But there is a commonality there, I think, in promoting a strong business climate in the state of Minnesota. Excuse me. State of North Dakota. Jeez, my phone didn't go off, but they're okay.
No, that's okay.
I said the M word. I'm so sorry.
The other question I have is in regards to your, I believe it's in your rebuttal testimony, Schedule 1, which would be the Wisconsin order. Page 11 is the discussion of the annual incentive pay denial.
Okay, I'm with you there.
The commission there states at the second, it'd be the second full sentence, according to the overall company performance component, which establishes the company's ability to pay, certain targeted earnings per share goals must be achieved by the company before the program will pay any rewards. Could you describe what that means, the certain targeted earnings per share goals must be met?
I do not have the design of the compensation program in front of me. I mean, a portion of it is a financial target that relates to earnings per share. So I think we do set goals for ourselves that we communicate to the financial markets as well, and I presume it ties to that.
So the incentive pay only kicks in if the company makes a certain amount of money? Is that how this kind of reads?
I think, you know, again, since I'm not fully conversant with the design of the incentive plan, perhaps I could direct you to a different witness to, I think we have an expert witness on that, Sharon Koenig.
Okay. I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, do you have any other questions?
I have no questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioners, Commissioner Fedorchik?
None for me.
Commissioner Kalk, you have a question?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor. I actually had one before we got back to the redirect, if you don't mind if I ask that question.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify, Laura, with your background in transmission. This transmission cost recovery rider that you're proposing, that's new for North Dakota jurisdiction, correct? We've never done anything like that before in North Dakota?
I may be wrong, but I believe that it's in place for Otter Tail Power and MDU.
Okay. But it's new for
Xcel. New for Xcel Energy, yes.
And then, I try not to make decisions while I'm sitting here, but to me, it looks like it might be the only alternative short of a rate case every year. Is that the same way you'd see the transmission rider, that if the commission wouldn't go with some kind of rider, we're going to be in here every year for a rate case?
Well, Commissioner, I think that does tie back to the one of the proposals that I made, which was for a capital step in the next year. And also,
where is that at? You said you made that proposal. Is that somewhere in the record that we can refer to, or is that just what you did today?
Commissioner, that is in my rebuttal testimony.
Okay. All right.
And would be glad to explore that further with staff.
No, I think we're good, Laura. I think you answered my question there. And then I need to follow up on what Mr. Morrell pointed back, because if you look at, what's the name of this exhibit, Your Honor, the one that Mr.
10?
Exhibit
ESC 10.
I just wanted to, Laura, if you take page 2 and look down to the second from the bottom up, do you see where it says Jay Scabo, MDU
yes.
Resources Group?
Yes.
So that would be a counterpart of Xcel if it was your corporate. What would we call Xcel's equivalent of MDU Resources?
Is MDU Resources their parent
company? Yeah.
Xcel Energy would be the equivalent then.
So is Mr. Nisbet employed just with the utility company, or is he employed in both areas?
Nisbet is entirely an NSP Minnesota company employee.
Okay. I just think it's just a nuance, in my personal opinion, it's just a nuance of how this is. And I know that it's belonging to these organizations. I know that oftentimes we'll seek Xcel's viewpoints on testimony, and actually, quite honestly, in 1064, we have Carly McLeod out here from Utility Shareholders. Xcel was a supporter of that through Utility Shareholders in North Dakota. That's the way I understand that, but I wanted to make sure that you also work through that you're aware that you work through Utility Shareholders, if you had any comment on that, for your lobbying efforts, if you will.
We certainly provide support to the North Dakota Utility Investor Company. I think that they represent their shareholders. That's their prime mission, is to represent people who own stock, I should say stockholders in the companies. So, and I don't argue with your representation that we supported that. I wasn't directly involved, but I take your position on that.
Okay, and then the follow-on of donations. In another similar scenario with Otter Tail, this came up. And the commission at that time, myself, Commissioner Clark, and Kramer, basically agreed that we did not want to have ratepayer dollars going for that. We not made any decisions here. But we talked with the company about a phase-out of that. If the commission would decide to say no on that, would a phase-out plan be something that may be acceptable? Or would that be one of those things that if you can't have it, you just, I mean, it's either in or out?
Well, Commissioner, I await your decision on that. I think if we are...
Okay.
We would like to recover 50% of those costs.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Commissioner Christman?
No further questions, Your Honor.
Ms. Valley, any further questions?
Thank you. No, Your Honor.
Mr. Norrell?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No.
Okay. No more from the commission. That will be all. Ms. McCartan, you're excused.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. At this time, Ms. Valley... identify your next witness, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. The company calls as its next witness, Mr. Steve Foss.
All right, Mr. Foss. Mr. Foss, were you present earlier when I instructed about perjury and penalties for perjury?
Yes, I was.
All right, thank you. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth under the pains and penalties of perjury? If so, answer, I do.
I do.
Thank you. All right. And I believe you have a prepared witness opening statement.
Yes, I do.
That is now being passed out to the commissioners and Mr. Norrell and everyone. All right. Ms. Valley, you may proceed.
Thank you.
First of all, we'll identify this. You have marked as NSP Exhibit 24. And is there going to be any objection, Mr. Norrell?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. That exhibit is admitted. Go ahead.
And Mr. Foss, you have in front of you what has been marked also as Exhibit 7 as your pre-filed direct testimony already admitted into the record in this proceeding. Do you have any corrections to that testimony?
No.
And Mr. Foss, please proceed with your opening statement.
Thank you. My testimony discusses the 2013 capital and O&M budgets for operations organization, which includes energy supply, transmission, and distribution. Operations is focused on excellence in employee and public safety, continuous improvement, and efficiency. Our goal is to provide the safe and reliable service our customers expect. While each major function within operations has a slightly different planning and budgeting process due to the business they manage, overall our processes are extensive and comprehensive and entail significant analysis and review. The 2013 capital and O&M budgets reflected in this rate application include expenditures we expected at the time to incur. Since the original filing, we have made changes to some projects and appropriate adjustments were made and described in Ms. Hoyer's rebuttal testimony. One of these adjustments was to remove the emissions control chemicals and avoidable O&M costs at Unit 3 of our largest coal plant, the Sherco facility, for the first 9 months of 2013. As discussed in our status reports to the Commission, the turbine failure in November of 2011 caused major damage to the plant. We have managed the massive repair effort with two fundamental objectives in mind. First, doing the job right so Sherco 3 can provide safe and reliable services for many years to come. And second, protecting the interests of our customers. The Sherco 3 project work is progressing well. The extensive investigation of the event indicates that the original cause was a failure of the mechanical connections between the low-pressure turbine blades and the rotor. The failure was not one we could have predicted or prevented. All major equipment restoration and reassembly work has been completed, and we are in the final stages of testing. We expect the plant to be back in service and in use to serve our customers around the end of September. Maintaining and improving reliability for our North Dakota customers is an important priority for our operations area. The reliability of our North Dakota operations continues to be the best in the NSP system. As part of our settlement agreement in the last rate case, several reliability-based commitments were made, each of which has been completed or is in the process, including the establishment of a North Dakota-focused reliability performance plan approved in late 2012. The investments and costs that we have included in the test year for the operations organization are what we believe to be necessary to maintain the high-quality, safe, and reliable service our North Dakota customers expect. Commissioners, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I will do my very best to answer any questions you or your staff may have about my testimony in this case. Thank you.
The witness is available for cross-examination.
Thank you, Ms. Valley. Mr. Norrell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Foss, and everybody in the room, I'd like to refer everyone to PSC Exhibit 8. And Mr. with the court's permission, I'd like to, the judge's permission, I'd like to approach the witness with this as well.
Go ahead, Mr. Norrell.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
This was a question I'd asked Ms. McCartan as she'd referred it to you. And so were you in the room when I'd asked the question regarding items 7 and 12? We've got two failures here, both over an hour long, both over 1,000 customers. But the outage report says that the criteria has not been met to replace these lines. What does it take to meet that criteria to replace this, especially in light of a rate increase like this?
Yeah, but we have several guidelines that our engineers utilize. Simply stated, we look at first, does it have two failures within 2 years? And that would be criteria one that our engineers would look at. Within that, there are a few more, details depending that our engineers would look at depending on, how it's segmented and that type of thing. But the short version is two outages in 2 years, within 2 years, and that it's meeting the replacement criteria. Secondly, as it related to our 500 MCM cable that we've talked about, the proactive program to replace, if it's a 500 MCM cable, it would then go on the list for replacement at that point. It would not require the 2 years. Now, I would, comment that, as these outages occur, certainly, our first action is to attempt to get things back in service. So we may replace that cable at that time. We may, or more likely, would be attempting to splice it to return service. And then is where our engineers would take a look at our criteria, the particular situation, and make a determination whether it goes on the schedule to be, eventually completed.
All right. I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, any questions?
Towards the end of your testimony, you talk about adding performance metrics to drive employee engagement and operational excellence. I think it's page 36. Can you give me some idea what you're talking about there?
There's probably a lot of examples depending on the business segments. I'll speak to distribution, which is an area that I'm involved in. Certainly we're starting to put more and more in place related to cost per unit, I would say, looking at the productivity of our crews. We have measures currently, estimate to actuals, where we're looking at, if it's designed this way and estimated, are our crews being productive and accomplishing it in that manner? That would be two examples.
Could you be a little more specific with one of those?
Sure. So,
still general.
Yes. So, for instance, on a cost per unit measure, we would look at some different segments of our distribution business that we typically spend a lot of resource on. For instance, the replacement of underground cables. We know roughly what a cost per unit typically would be on average, and we would track each project to see how we performed against that to determine whether, there's improvements, discussions with employees, that could be made in that process.
Is the incentive pay tied to those?
No, it's not. Nope.
So they're just used not for compensation at all, but simply for changing something in operations to improve
I would say that's generally accurate. However, you know, the management staff, using this example within distribution, to the extent that, you know, we choose to focus on that in a particular area and put it into their performance plan to try to drive a change, it would certainly impact their individual performance, which eventually has some tie to their compensation, but not directly to the incentive.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. At this time, we'll go to the commission. Commissioner Fedorchik.
Good afternoon.
Welcome. Good afternoon.
In your testimony on page 6, in your original testimony, you outline, table 2 outlines your 5-year kind of capital expenditure plan. What are we looking at from this included in this rate case? What's included? Just the 2013 stuff?
Yes. But, I mean, in particular, the plan additions would probably be the bigger driver on table 1. So that would outline, you know, the capital additions that are going in plan and service that eventually work into the revenue requirements that Ms. Hoyer, you know, utilizes. So what you're seeing there is over a 2-year period, the additions in 2012 and 13, the addition of $923 million in plan and service for those three business areas. What Table 2 then references is actually the capital expenditures leading up to those additions. And then this provides a forward look at what our current forecasts are for those years. So the 2013 column would be, you know, what we would say our 2013 capital expenditure budget is. And then this would be a forward look at currently what we're seeing out there and it projected as part of our budgeting process.
And is this how it typically looks when you're building out? What does it, when you're not doing these massive upgrades and build-outs, what does that, what would that table look like, a 5-year capital expenditure? What's normal, if you say?
You know, I don't really know what's normal, you know, dating back. I'm not sure that there is. You know, but I would comment, you know, possibly an indicator there is if you look at energy supply, you can see a fairly stable expenditure pattern. So, you know, this is does not include nuclear. So this is our coal, you know, and gas units for NSP Min, and you can see a fairly stable capital expenditure. So not a lot of build-out, as discussed, you know, within my testimony, focus on more modernization, you know, and updating those existing plants. Similar on the distribution, you can see a slight ramp-up, but not a large build-up. A lot of our focus, as discussed in my testimony, is in modernization and some of our reliability programs. What you can see, however, in the transmission is the build-out that I believe you may be referring to on the transmission. In 2013, as an example, if you look at the $500 million number, you know, approximately 66% of that is CapEx expenditures. Similar in 2014, approximately 50% of that $397 million is CapEx. And then you can see kind of the ramp down of the CapEx programs, the Group 1 programs, during that period.
Okay. And then in his questioning, Mr. Norrell asked Laura about this chart, page 9 of this, what did you call it? The NDPSC data request 10-003. Are you familiar with this? Would you be the correct person among the witnesses to discuss why NSP Minnesota is at their percent non-fuel O&M is at more than 30% of retail revenue versus Xcel Energy as a whole or NSP Wisconsin, which is way down at 15%?
I'm not familiar with it, and I'm not sure I would be the right person. But
I'd like someone to explain why there's such a big difference between the O&M expenditures for NSP Minnesota versus Wisconsin or Xcel as a whole.
Yeah, I'm not sure who could address that. I don't know that offhand here to answer that question. And whatever I would tell you would probably be a speculation.
Okay. All right, that's it for me.
Thank you, Commissioner Fedorchik. Commissioner Kalk?
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve, for your testimony. You have to talk to your boss, Laura, and ask her why she couldn't get through hers as quick as you got through yours. Just are you the best person to talk about this transmission rider? Or is there a future witness dedicated to that?
Yeah, I would not be the right person. I'm kind of the operations person. I guess I defer to our attorneys on who you may suggest.
So cost allocation issues, you wouldn't want to talk about those?
No, I wouldn't.
We're just wearing it down here. In the previous rate case, you talked about in your testimony, the commission, I wouldn't even say we approved. I'd say we almost directed those 25 IntelliSwitches. Could we use those IntelliSwitches in Grand Forks or Minot?
Yeah, we're taking a look at that. You know, first of all, the main reason we focused in Fargo, it was related to the distribution system design.
Right.
You know, we have the different voltage. We have the 23.9, which typically we are carrying more customers on the feeder segments, which is where that Intelli team can really provide its value. You know, isolating, segmenting that and putting a lot of customers in quickly. You know, with the design of the system in Minot and Grand Forks, at the 13.8, 15 kV systems essentially, there's not as many opportunities. But I would say that in talking to our engineering group, we do think there may be some opportunities with some of the critical facilities in town, for us to take a look and see,
how would we wrap that up? Because I'd look forward to hearing your thoughts. If you think that we could use some in Grand Forks, that's something I would certainly be willing to look at, because the initial results for Fargo is it's made a difference, a positive difference.
Yeah,
how do we tie
whatever that mechanism we'd like to tie up? I mean, we certainly, we're looking at it right now, and certainly, we can commit, to provide an update of that, outside of this rate case or however you'd like to do that.
Would that be a late filed exhibit? But that's something that's kind of open ended. That it would be nice to the previous rate case. We basically just sat down and said, "You're going to do it," and then we said, "Figure it out." It'd be nice to have some dialogue from the company saying, yes, we think we could, if you could, use some of those in the Grand Forks area, then that'd be something we could certainly consider.
Well, I think if you ask the company if they would be able to produce such an exhibit, it would be appropriate as a late-filed exhibit. If the company is not able to answer that question, that's a difference. Nothing.
Do you think you could get something like that within the next 30 days?
We will do something.
All right. That would be great, Your Honor, to get a late-filed exhibit on IntelliTeam switches potential in Grand Forks and Minot, or maybe even additional ones needed in Fargo.
Okay. Do you understand what
I do.
Is being asked, Mr. Foss?
I do.
Okay. Then what we'd be looking at is late-filed exhibit, Exhibit D being a late-filed exhibit. Any objections? Counsel?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
All right. Late filed Exhibit D then will be admitted. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. The NERC reliability standards, or anything that's happened in an exhibit that's been talked about up in Grand Forks with a number of hours, is any of those in violation of NERC standards? That's not NERC standards jurisdiction, for lack of a better term, isn't it?
Could you restate that question?
Yeah, the standards for NERC, different standards,
yes.
How you do things. None of the outages that have happened in Grand Forks violate anything in the NERC standards.
I would have to verify, but my understanding is not. But I would have to verify that answer.
Okay. My assumption would be it wouldn't, but I wanted to double-check that question. Okay, that was all that I had, Your Honor.
Thank you. Commissioner Kalk, Commissioner Christman.
Your Honor, I have no questions for Mr. Foss.
Thank you. Ms. Valley, do you have any redirect?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Norrell, any further questions?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
Well, I do. I was going to ask if you were the appropriate witness for the cost accounting treatment for Brookings. And then when I heard the discourse, I was going to guess no. But there is a portion of your testimony, page 28, that talks about the transmission revenues from MISO. And what I wanted to know, if you're the appropriate person to answer, is are all the revenues credited back to customers through the fuel adjustment? All, you know, transmission revenues that come from MISO credited back to customers?
That would probably be something better answered by Ms. Hoyer, I believe.
Okay. That's all. Thank you.
Does anyone have any further questions for this witness? All right. Seeing no further questions, that will comprise your testimony. And thank you, Mr. Foss.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioners. Thank
you. All right. Ms. Valley, identify your next witness, please.
Thank you. The company calls as its next witness, Mr. Timothy J. O'Connor.
Thank you. And Mr. O'Connor, I believe you were present earlier when I instructed about penalties for perjury. Were you not?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth under pains and penalties of perjury?
I do.
Thank you. And is Ms. Paulson passing out the witness statement for Mr. O'Connor? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is NSP Exhibit 25. Is there any objection to this exhibit?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. NSP 25 is admitted. Ms. Valley, you may proceed.
Mr. O'Connor, as you walked up to the stand today, you were presented with copies of Exhibits NSP 8, NSP 9A, and NSP 9B. Those are copies of your public and non-public versions of the direct and rebuttal testimony filed in this case. Do you have any corrections to your testimony?
I have NSP 8 and NSP 9A.
Oh, I'm sorry. And 9B has been admitted separately as trade secret. I apologize, Mr. O'Connor. Do you have any corrections to your testimony?
No, I do not.
Thank you. Do you have an opening statement?
I do.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Tim O'Connor. I'm the Senior Vice President and Chief Nuclear Officer for Xcel Energy. The company has made and continues to make significant investment in the Prairie Island and the Monticello nuclear facilities to maximize the clean, reliable energy produced over their extended operating lives. The investments are necessary to keep the units operating and available as round-the-clock carbon-free base load units. The company is ensuring that it is efficiently using its nuclear plants by performing work necessary to extend the operating lives of all the plants and also increasing the generating capacity at Monticello. Monticello Extended Power Uprate Life Cycle Management Project will allow us to provide safe, reliable, low-cost energy to our customers through 2030. We are currently waiting for our power uprate license approval by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and have removed the licensing costs from our current rate request. However, all investments in the plant upgrades to date are in service and being used today to generate power, and our customers are currently benefiting from those investments. Therefore, as explained in my rebuttal testimony, the operating and maintenance costs for Monticello are not avoided due to the license delay. Rather, all these costs are currently being incurred as Monticello is in service and providing electricity to all of our customers. The nuclear operations arena is changing as safety continues to be redefined. Safe nuclear power operations is compliance-driven by an independent regulator, specifically the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Promulgating regulations in response to lessons learned from day-to-day operations of all nuclear plants operating worldwide. The Fukushima event is an example of a worldwide event reshaping nuclear safety and certainly USA nuclear operations. Public health and safety standards in nuclear operations are not stagnant, as demonstrated by the increased regulatory requirements. The license requirements under life extension are more stringent than those under the original license, and we are responding accordingly to ensure the safety and long-term availability of these key resources through their extended operating lives. In addition, nuclear employee retention is a significant issue. The nuclear industry is facing a decline inexperienced nuclear workers, as well as increased competition globally for those remaining experienced workers, which has contributed to a shortage of specialized skilled labor. We have implemented a practical and necessary plan for recruiting and retaining the highly qualified workforce to assure workforce stability, as our customers are better served by retaining the employees with the experience and skill sets necessary to keep our plants operating safely, efficiently, and effectively. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. The witness is available for cross-examination.
Thank you. Mr. Norrell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. O'Connor. My first question is just, could you address the company's outstanding license renewals? What is the status of those?
Are you referring to the extended licenses for the plants, or are you referring to...
The extended licenses, yes.
Monticello has been granted and is already in its new operating license, extended license life. It's a 20-year extension. Prairie Island Unit 1, both plants have been approved. Unit 1 went into its extended life August 9th, and Prairie Island Unit 2 will enter its new 20-year life a year from approximately today.
Does that mean that the I apologize. I'm getting notes here. On page 2 of your rebuttal, and you had stated here as well in your introductory statement that the Monticello upgrade is in service, or the Monticello, is the upgrade in service at this point right now? What's the status of that?
I think what you're referring to is the power upgrade
portion.
Piece. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, let me try to explain. Is the project that was undertaken for Monticello was twofold. First, it was to go into the extended operating license life of 20 more years, which required certain pieces of equipment to either be replaced, which is one option, or I would say re-engineered, which is another option. We chose to replace, and by doing that in a what I would say an engineered fashion, we could do it by replacing the equipment and affording us the ability to increase the power output of the plant simply by changing the size of some of the equipment that was in the facility. That's the project approach that we took to get a twofold outcome. All of the equipment necessary for current operating or running at the new 100% are in service running to the current license of 100% power. So if I replaced reactor feed pumps for the old condition, I'm running them now for the current condition as well as the anticipated higher output levels. We simply will increase the output of the existing equipment.
But the increase has not yet taken place yet, is that correct?
The increase has not been allowed yet by the NRC. However, the equipment is ready and in service, functioning, ready to go.
When do you anticipate the NRC will allow that increase to take place?
We've been in the process for a period of time. The next approval cycle for the NRC is actually coming up here September 5th with a subcommittee of the NRC or of the commissioners. Once that's done, within 30 to 40 days, we expect a recommendation to be made to the commissioners, at which point a license would either be granted or not. We expect, given all of our inputs, that the license will be granted.
Do you know how long after September 5th it would be, anticipating the approval, how long that would be? Are we talking weeks or months?
From the time that if I receive the license where I would, say, increase power, is that what you're asking?
Yes. Yep.
It would be approximately 40 to 60 days before we would see the first increase in power. And that's because of the license requirements between the NRC and us is that I may be allowed to go to a higher level, but we do it in increment stages, and that's to validate that the design and the analysis all support the mathematical models that have been done. And the NRC, because of experiences in the industry, has more of a integrated evaluation with the licensee as we raise power. So roughly, I would say it'll be about 60 days where we'll start to see the first power increase.
Okay. On page 13 of your rebuttal testimony, you state that you provide, I apologize, it's your direct testimony.
Direct, okay.
The wonders of technology here. Let me see if I can pull that up. You state that you could provide some additional information on the program to retain your nuclear employees. Could you describe what steps, I guess even regardless of what's in the testimony, what steps have you guys taken? Could you describe the company's plan to retain nuclear employees?
Are you on a particular page just so I'm on the same that you are? I'm on page 13 of direct, and I don't think that's the correct place you
it's
are.
It's rebuttal. I'm sorry.
Is it rebuttal?
Yes, rebuttal. It would be line 25, page 13.
And what was the question, Mr. Norrell?
The question is just additional information was submitted by Mr. O'Connor. If he could just give an overview of that additional information, what kind of plans are in place regarding the retention?
The plans that the economics of the plans, I would refer to another witness. The philosophy of the plan, I can certainly give you understanding. Is that what you're asking, or are you looking for the details of the numbers?
Even a philosophy of the plan would be fine.
I'll explain the philosophy. That's the one I can give best. As I said in my opening remarks, the industry is shrinking in experienced workers. Baby boomers, a lack of interest in nuclear has shrunk the experience level. This is not an industry that takes people directly from the outside and just puts them in jobs because of the consequences and ramifications that come from making mistakes. So there's a great deal of experience that's necessary, particularly in decision making. So that's very high premium to obtain, and that knowledge base has begun to shrunk because of disinterest in nuclear, retirements, and so on. And we have experienced that it's America, and people have choices, and they do make it when there is better competition than me. Quite frankly, a workforce that is in constant turnover is not a good recipe for, I would say, sustainable nuclear operations, and therefore we experienced some losses and found that we had to change our attraction and retention in order for us to keep that experience and therefore keep the stability in our power plants and therefore have more predictability behind the operations. And that's exactly what it was designed to do. It was simply to relook at market competitiveness, look at our competition, and structure ourselves so that we were more in those lines.
Is it, what do you think drives a lack of interest in the nuclear employment arena?
It's not an easy game. I think that the pressures that are put on engineers, on managers and supervisors, it's a 24/7 job. It is extremely regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It isn't just, in fact, there are people that are assigned to the sites on a 24, basically 7 basis. So every activity that employee does is being watched. It's not being watched the way you would watch me. It's being watched to look at every single detail. It's a precision type of approach. That puts a lot of pressure on people. I find that some people don't like that and don't think that that's something they want, the stress in their lives, and they have choices and they decide to get away from it. I think that's one impact. Over the last 15 years, the interest in nuclear from schools has reduced, and so the candidates coming out of schools don't meet what I would say are the types of entry criteria that they used to, And so we find that the inputs or the sources have started to shrink, and the military itself, which is another source that we go to, has also shrunk in available resources.
You had mentioned that some of the entry-level candidates that come in aren't necessarily, for lack of a better term, you didn't say this, I apologize, I'm rephrasing, but not up to par or subpar or whatever it might be.
Not experienced yet.
Yeah, there you go. Case in point. Anyway, is what would
I'm sure you do well.
Could the company look at ways to invest in those employees to make them to grant them? Is there anything that they can grant in lieu of experience from the company side to bring them up to a level that you would feel comfortable with?
I think what you're asking is the company participating in any kind of educational or program alliances with schools or other types of sources? Is that what you're asking?
That's one way of looking at it. Or just what can the company do to help those entry-level people get to the level that they need?
Yes, we do have. First, the company does have we have very robust qualification programs for all of our employees. Every single employee, including me, is trained and qualified and receives a qualification status for being able to perform various types of things in the facility. They can range from a 6-month period to as much as a 2.5-year time period for someone to gain, I'll call it additional education, experience, and then demonstration of that experience before a qualification is given. Very similar to, say, a physician in an internship. And so the company has those established for engineers, for managers, for mechanics, technicians, all of the different skill sets that we use in the facilities. But as I said, it takes time. And if you see a loss with bringing in new, that's a good thing, but it takes time for you to be able to optimize the usage of those people. So you're left with essentially having to go find that gap filler with experience from other places until your own come up to speed. And so it's a combination. I want external plus experience as the right mix, I think, for long-term operations of our facility. And then on top of that, we do have now alliances and programs with local universities, both on the professional side and non-professional side, to, I would say, create more career paths for people to want to come into the nuclear facilities. And we're starting to see some shift in that direction positively. It's getting better, but it's a ways to go yet.
Is it fair to say that the company is concerned about the long-term operations and in lieu of this lack of interest and having available workers?
Well, I would say that our concern is having a long-term workforce, which is one reason why we've increased our staffs a bit, was so that knowing it takes several years to qualify, knowing the I would say the retirement probabilities of our workforce, we try to make sure that we're accommodating that potential so that we keep a stability in the long term of the pipeline for our power plants. It's working very effectively, but it is something we have to keep constant vigilance on.
You had mentioned the Fukushima event. Is that the incident in Japan with
yes,
the tidal wave? Are there any similarities to environmental threats at Monticello that they faced in Japan in that incident? Or what? I'll leave the question there first.
First of all, I'm into event prevention, not just event mitigation. The only place and the only way to operate facilities is to prevent situations that we're seeing on television overseas. Is the possibility that we could have an event that is like that? I would say that's very low in probability, and quite frankly, the United States has a very different operating philosophy than the Japanese do. As an anecdotal example, I have run some of these same accident scenarios in our simulators, and with our mitigating strategies for safety of the plant, for protection, we don't come up with the same outcomes.
I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
Is the employee, excuse me, scratchy throat, the attracting qualified employees and retaining them, is the incentive plan for that, for the nuclear portion of the business, the same as for the rest of the utility? Or is there a special one for the nuclear employees?
We have we're part of the whole, but there are some special attributes that have been applied for the nuclear side.
And I apologize if this is in buried in somebody's testimony someplace, but is there, can you point to the cost difference in the rate case, in the revenue requirement for the year, for the nuclear portion above and beyond the general portion?
I would ask, I don't think I'm the correct witness for that. I would ask that one of the witnesses coming after me can answer that on the retention, or I mean on the compensation program as a whole, including the nuclear piece.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, at this time, we'll go to the commission. Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Tim, some comments have been made that nuclear was less volatile from a regulatory standpoint. You're talking about a lot of measures needing to be taken because of regulations. So talk to me a little bit about whether nuclear really is less or more volatile from a regulatory standpoint than, say, some of the fossil fuels.
I don't know if I can say that nuclear is more or less. As safety standards get redefined by industry experiences, regulations change. I think that's the case no matter what you're talking about, whether you're talking about OSHA standards for safety on humans or you're talking about nuclear regulatory items or effluents from a fossil plant. So the regulations are coming from, at least from the nuclear piece, is redefining safety as lessons learned come in and assuring that similar instances don't occur. Now, it's a moving target at times. That's a true statement. Do I think it's predictable? I think we understand the Fukushima situation very clearly in the U.S., and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, I think, has done a very good job in phasing approaches and having cost benefits for doing the right things for the right reasons. And so I see there are some increases that are coming from those, but I see some level of predictability also with that. That's the answer I would provide.
Do you think that we're going through a period now where there's some new regulations that are built on the lessons learned from that event, and then it'll stabilize?
I don't have a crystal ball, but I would tell you that the Fukushima experience is pretty much through the regulatory new rule writing that the NRC and commissioners have been doing. There are some that we know what they will look like, but the rule hasn't been written, but we're already anticipating what we think those changes or expectations on our plants are. The NRC has expected that all industry nuclear plants will implement all of those items over the next 5 years. And then at that point, I would say this situation, I think, is behind us.
So more than 50% of the costs that you're recovering here are focused on the nuclear side. And you obviously have determined that this is a good investment, this is wise. Tell us why. How did you guys determine this? And why are you comfortable that investing this much in the nuclear portfolio is a good investment at this point?
Well, even with the some of the rule changes, when you look at a base load unit running 24/7, I really don't change my workforce very often. I mean, I have to have the right workforce, and I have to deal with turnover, but the labor force, the maintenance costs associated with running the plant are fairly predictable, assuming regulations don't change a whole lot, but they're fairly predictable to run the machine. And when you look at that, which is a low cost with the energy that you get from nuclear fuel, it's still a very, very competitive amongst all other resources that are out there. It's clean, and it's extremely reliable, meaning it's very, you can count on it. I'll give you an example. The Prairie Island Unit 2 reactor is now in day 500 of continuous operation. That's a phenomenal reliability statistic for baseload units. And that type of clean energy, that kind of reliability is what we offer to the customers. And I personally believe, the company believes, that the economics still show it as being a very good investment for customers for the long term.
Okay. Now, just to get, again, kind of the big picture here, I was looking at the chart on the drivers of the costs. And it showed, I believe, I can pull this up. Where is that? $8.4 million, I believe, were related to the nuclear. And then in your testimony, I can't find a chart that breaks down that $8.4 million. I see a chart that breaks down like 10.4 or 10.7. in nuclear generation business area O&M costs, but am I understanding these correctly? Is the 8.4 and the 10.7, are these the same figures, or where can I get a breakdown of the nuclear components of the case, the drivers?
I'm not sure the 8.4 that you're referring to. I'm sorry, that one but the table, I'm familiar with the table, okay. And I know what that is. I don't know if there's been any adjustment.
Well,
I can't answer that.
The 8.4 is from this chart on page 5 of Ms. Of Laura's testimony at the beginning, this one. Are you familiar with that?
I have seen it. I have not studied it.
So should that be 8.4? Should that be 10.7?
I'm sorry, I can't answer that question.
Okay, let me ask it this way. Is 10.7 the right number for total nuclear?
The 10.7 is what our change is from 1 year to another year. Now, what that converts to in actual change in rates, that I'm sorry, I can't give you that answer. What I'm explaining in that testimony is what's the difference in the nuclear costs from 1 year to another year, and what was the primary drivers for it.
Okay, then how do I get to that, from that to how much of that percent, how much of that is into the rate case, the money that we're seeking to recover?
I'm sorry, I'd have to refer to others to help with that answer. I didn't make those conversions. I don't know.
Okay. Then let's talk a little bit about employees. Because that is a big driver, it sounds like, and the cost, a lot of it is coming down to employees, the cost of retaining them and
it is
and training them. Where are your employees coming from? Where are the training programs for these employees?
The training programs are Excel training programs. So we have a combination of hiring what I would say less experienced and using our training programs to bring them up to an experienced mm-hmm. qualified level. And quite frankly, is going out to the industry and obtaining them who already have the qualifications. For example, the Kewaunee plant that shut down in Wisconsin was a source for us to obtain already trained and qualified people. The plant in San Onofre in California is a second plant that we actually were able to go out and recruit and bring experienced, qualified people into our facility. Those are two places that have been very successful for us.
So it's pretty much all on-the-job training?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
A great portion of it is.
What percent of your staff is it on-the-job training versus, you know, a nuclear engineers and those folks that graduate from a four-year or six-year program?
Speaking from experience, since I am an engineer, I would say that you have to have a degree to understand the business and understand the technical aspects of it. But from the total operation of the facility, it's maybe 10% of what you get from our nuclear programs and the on-the-job experience. 90% comes from the actual implant and in the job itself.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys have recruiting programs through the trade schools and the universities to try to get in and bring in, draw in more talent?
We do. We actually, as I had mentioned earlier, Commissioner, that over the last couple of years, we've had to help universities with pipelines so that they structure their programs, not only the four-year programs, but the two-year associate programs. And most recently, we've interacted with the Institute of Nuclear Power for the trade schools so that we can get welders and we can get various types of other skills that are essential, you know, for operating our facilities for the long term. Those programs are starting to infiltrate into their journeyman sessions, and we're starting to see, in fact, this past year we had our first seven graduates that we were able to get from that program and bring into our nuclear facilities. So it's working, but it's got a ways to go yet.
Mm-hmm. And did this suddenly come up, or why this? It sort of seems like the industry is a little behind the eight ball on the staffing. Why is this now such a big issue?
Well, as I said, there aren't too many. I'll try to say this as delicately as I can, since I'm in the 50 category. Mm-hmm. There's either someone who's 20 or 50, and in between, not much. And what's happening is, the people that have the – there was a period of time that there was not a lot of recruiting, not a lot of what I would say there was a good deal of stability and assumptions that I think people would come into the business, and that did not turn out to be true. In the last 5 to 8 years, that recognition that the schools aren't promoting nuclear like they used to computer science and those types of things are far more exciting than some of the things that we do. And the fact that the population is starting to shrink with us that are in the higher ages is starting to show a deficit.
All right. That concludes my questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Tim, for your testimony. Interesting to bring up San Onofre. I got a chance to tour that place. And so when does that close down again, you said? They're all done now?
It's already the announcement's already done. It's already shut down.
Fair enough. Just a couple questions for you. The 2030-ish, you feel now that with the improvements you've made, the plant will be able to run till 2030, right?
Yes, sir.
I'll tell you, from my viewpoint, the ADP to approve the what you did for that plant was the easiest decision I've made in the commission, because as far as the nuclear power, I mean, it's good power all the way around. Is there something that we could do now that would be able to extend the plant past 2030, or is the limiting factor just the federal approval of this facility?
Well, let me answer it this way. Is the current regulatory process was a new plant is 40 years, a license extension is 20. Why those numbers... I would say was more, those were numbers that were pretty defendable for various safety analyses on materials and that type of, I will say, structures. There is a great deal of energy right now in licensing past 60 years. with EPRI and NEI and some of the, I'll call it, larger utilities. My personal view is that we will see nuclear plants going past 60 years, in other words, 40 plus 20. I expect that you'll see past 60 become more likely in the next 5 to 10 years.
Is there a role that the North Dakota Commission or Minnesota Commission could play to help you extend those life cycles? I mean, could we then intervene on your behalf with the authorities to grant those? We do that all the time. We find a good energy source, we'll say it's good for policy or good for the ratepayers, and we'll make sure it's around. Is this something that we should be looking at now as a commission to start weighing in with the discussion?
Commissioner, well, obviously I'm a nuclear type of person, so I would always say that there's a possibility. You know, I think the comment that was made earlier about we have to look at the economics, we have to look at the risk factors, we have to look at, regulatory environments. It may or may not be the right decision in 2030. I don't know. I'd like it to be out there in the future. I'm not sure what the United States will do without nuclear power, but it's certainly the policy setting and how the Nuclear Regulatory Commission looks at business is something I think all of us should participate in some fashion to help them shape policy most effectively.
Okay. And then speaking of policy, you talked in your testimony a little bit about the dry cask storage issues. I see one of the D.C. courts now basically said Congress didn't have the right to stop the moving forward of the storage issue, something to that effect.
Yes. The specific issue was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission decided that it was no longer going to continue the licensing efforts of Yucca Mountain. And they made that decision independently of the court's, federal rules or federal law. And the court system said that the NRC didn't have that authority to just say, we're not going to do it. So they told them they have to go back and continue the licensing efforts with Yucca Mountain. Whether that happens or not, I don't know.
So if we are somehow able to keep this plant going, is there a limiting time frame for the current storage plan that will become the limiting factor in this plant?
No. That's, and I think probably one reason why there's some extended times on Yucca Mountain and these kinds of long-term repositories is because both by testing and by actual operations, dry cask storage has been proven to be extremely safe and can go on for an extended period of time, well beyond probably what is currently licensed. And I think many know that, and I think that's one reason why it's taking time to come up with a long-term storage is because the existing methods are very safe and very practical.
Okay. And then
the answer is I don't see that influencing operations of our facilities.
Okay. The toured the plant out there in Monticello. The physical security, I understand, you have your own unique plan out there. But is the cybersecurity set up different for the nuclear plant than your other facilities, or is it all one integrated security plan?
Nuclear is different. There is cybersecurity for the company as a whole. However, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has issued specific cybersecurity directions for various types of components and systems directed at nuclear power plants as standalone laws and orders.
So to get right to the punchline, with the physical upgrades that you've done, do you feel you've done enough upgrades for the computer security, or is that something that maybe you could use some more resources to upgrade?
We're well on our way. We have to be completed with those by the second quarter of 2014, and that's the path that we're on. So we have ourselves positioned to meet that.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Christman.
Your Honor, Mr. O'Connor, how far are Prairie Island and Monticello apart geographically?
Oh, I would say about an hour and 45 minutes, so I drive it a lot. So I'd say hour 45 minutes, maybe a little around 100 miles.
When we talk about the regulatory requirements for safety and well, all kinds of requirements that are leading to these costs, are there state regulatory requirements that exceed the federal requirements that are a part of this, or are state regulations not exceeding federal?
The latter is true. Nuclear power plants are governed by the Code of Federal Regulations, and they supersede any state item. Probably the only one area is effluent monitoring and of the facilities, water and air. The state criteria is what we follow.
Were there concessions made some years ago when one or both of these facilities needed more storage space? Anything in order to get the state regulatory approval to add storage?
I guess I'm not sure I can answer that question. I don't know.
Okay. I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Your Honor, I'd maybe follow up on what Commissioner Christman was.
Okay, Commissioner Kalk.
Commissioner Christman, didn't the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, though, have you guys hung up a little bit for a while on these some extensions?
There has been. Are you talking about extensions for license? There are several licenses.
But the Minnesota PUC has more jurisdiction over what you do. They have some hammer over the nuclear plants because you're physically in Minnesota. It's not all federal jurisdiction.
For, I believe, dry cast storage, that is a true statement.
Okay, so the state of Minnesota could make a policy change that could make operations a lot tougher. And that was some debate a while back, I think.
I suppose that's possible.
Okay. I don't know if that's what you were driving at, but I remember that discussion that you're talking about. Thank you.
Any follow-up, Commissioner Christman?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. O'Connor, I want to ask one question, but I want to comment first. When I was on the commission, I had the opportunity to tour the Prairie Island plant, and while I was there, there was a simulation. As much as you were talking about going through, you know, some various scenarios. And as I recall, because it was a pretty vivid experience, the simulation was one of the worst-case scenarios, and I heard them say something like, this is kind of what happened at Fukushima. It was a meltdown. Rather spine-chilling, by the way. but when you talked about what could happen here being very low compared to what happened at Fukushima, what were you comparing? Was it because of the we've heard about the way the government in Japan kind of at the top level decisions when you can actually take action and intervene, and it seemed there was a lot of delay that maybe then led to one disaster after another that might have been curtailed sooner if they could have gotten in there. Is that what you're referring to, or are you referring to like actual technical steps?
All of the above.
All of the above.
If I might, I can explain that a bit.
Please.
If you take a step back and look at the Fukushima situation, the first thing is that the operating approaches is that in the U.S., every operator that's on the boards that's managing the reactor itself is federally licensed by the government to take actions that they see fit in order to reduce any kind of concern to health and safety of the public. That's their primary objective. They do that before they take an order from me. In the Japanese society, so decision-making is left to the control room, who are best suited to evaluate the situation and, given the different circumstances, make the best decision. In Japan, that decision-making is not left in the control room. It's, as you pointed out, it's elevated outside of the control room to those who have less firsthand knowledge. Delays did occur, and the situation got worse, not better. And when actions did take, it was a little bit late. That's one problem. After 9/11, in the U.S., there were a variety of different changes we took, both in security and worst-case scenarios about our nuclear facilities. That prompted us to change, again, our methods of auxiliary equipment in the event of a worst-case scenario. So let's say you have a loss of power. Nobody's coming to help you. Can you remedy the situation on your own? The U.S. required in early years after 9/11 to put auxiliary equipment in to provide additional power, to provide additional water, and to provide different methods for fire suppression should we have any or all of these combinations to keep fuel covered at all times. And that's the mission of the U.S., keep the fuel covered at all times. That's, again, a different approach than the Japanese took. They did not apply security issues that we did from 9/11. And then finally, the U.S. went into what's called beyond design basis situations. The plants are designed for a certain type of accidents, but and we said, well, what if it goes past that? So we created more procedures and more training scenarios for our operators, our maintenance and engineers for those types of situations. That was all to try to take high consequence but extremely low probability situations and be sure that we could, in fact, implement plans and not have an outcome that we're experiencing overseas. Those are the three larger differences that I'm referring to as to why I believe those are very low probability concerns or conditions in the U.S. as compared to overseas.
Thank you. That's an excellent explanation of the security measures. Ms. Valley, do you have any questions?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Norrell, any follow-up?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No, thank you.
Commissioners, any follow-up? No follow-up. Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Okay, is your next witness going to be Sharon Koenig?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, we're going to take about a 10-minute break here, give the court reporter a chance to refresh.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And the commissioners a chance to refresh.